CSAT's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Matt Ridley. Matt is many things: biologist, businessman, journalist, writer, thinker, and member of the House of Lords in the United Kingdom. He has a DPhil or PhD in zoology and spent 9 years at The Economist magazine as their science editor and America editor. He's been a columnist for many newspapers, The Telegraph, The London Times, and The Wall Street Journal, where he founded the excellent Mind and Matter column. And he's the author of many great non-fiction books, and several of them have been bestsellers and translated into many languages. If I'm only allowed to pick 3 books by Matt that I haven't just enjoyed reading but also learned a lot from, I would start with The Red Queen, a book about evolution and the role that sexual selection plays for the evolution. That book came in the early 1990s when it was pretty controversial, at least outside the faculties of science, to discuss sex, selection, and the evolution of human nature. Perhaps one could say that this subject is still controversial, but in a time when a lot of people know the difference between swiping left or right on Tinder, it should be difficult to keep a straight face while making a point that we shouldn't explore how sexual selection moves our species forward. The second book I'd recommend is The Origins of Virtue, which tracks the sociobiological history of human morality and how people cooperate with each other. And third, The Rational Optimist, a book that follows in the same footsteps and shows, with a long historical account, how human collaboration has given us gradually increasing levels of prosperity and helped us to solve problems. It's a history of specialization and how we learn to work for each other. In a few weeks' time, Matt's new book will be out, and it's called How Innovation Works. It gives a fascinating account of innovation, from steam engines to search engines, and the strange way that innovations actually come about in fields like energy, transport, health, and more. I've learned a lot from it, and I urge you all to order the book right away. The book will be out in the UK on June 25th, but I just heard from Matt that it's going to be out in America sooner than that. But wherever in the world you are, I urge you to pre-order a copy of it already now. Matt, that was a long introduction, but it's a great honor to have you on the podcast, and I wanted to give listeners a short introduction to your previous books.
Well, thank you, Frederick. And it was not only a long introduction, but a very accurate one. As far as I can tell, you perceived a lot of good points about what I've been trying to argue in my book in very brief form. And I should add that I'm someone who's been heavily influenced by you, not only in your journalism and report writing, but also your book, The Innovation Illusion, which I found very helpful when I was writing the last chapters of my book on how innovation works. I think that I always think my last book is my most interesting, yes. But I genuinely think this one is a very important topic, and it's one that you and I have been thinking about in different ways for quite a long time.
Indeed, we have, and we're very soon going to talk about your book and innovation, and I don't want us to get diverted right away, but when I prepared for this podcast and when I thought about your past books, it also struck me that I should ask you the same question. So when you look back, which of your books do you think mattered the most? And I should say perhaps that you can measure that in different ways: the intellectual achievement itself, the effort involved in writing the books, or the reaction to them.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because I seem to have a habit of writing a bestseller and then a non-bestseller, one that really doesn't succeed very well at all immediately afterwards. So The Red Queen slowly became a bestseller, but The Origins of Virtue was never a very successful book. But in some ways, it's a more original and interesting book. It has a rather devoted following in a few people. Likewise, I wrote Genome, which was my most successful book in terms of commercial sales because it was very timely. It was about how genes work, and it came out around the same time as the human genome was sequenced. It had a gimmicky structure, 23 chapters, one for each chromosome, and that helped make it a great success, that and the timeliness of it. But it's not my most profound book, for certain. The book I wrote immediately after that, called Nature Via Nurture, is a, I think, very good analysis. Well, you know, I can't say my own book are good, but I think it's a very deep analysis of a very much more important issue.
I agree.
Almost was a disaster. I mean, very few people bought it. and likewise, The Rational Optimist was my next most successful book. In fact, it may almost have overtaken Genome Now as my best-selling book. But what people take from it is simply this message that the world is getting better. They don't tend to focus on the analysis of exchange and specialization that I think lies at the heart of that process and that I discuss in all sorts of different ways in the book. And then I wrote The Evolution of Everything immediately after that, which is a book that tries to argue that we make the creationist mistake of thinking that the human world is run by people when it's not. It's a bottom-up phenomenon much more than we think. And again, that hasn't been such a successful book. So I'm due a bestseller, which may be how innovation works will be. But I would say that my most profound books are not my best-selling books necessarily. And so there are different criteria for how much one enjoys one's books. It'll be very interesting. I mean, it's now more than 25 years since The Red Queen came out. And going back and reading it, you know, I see all sorts of naive, foolish things that a young man wrote. But I also think, wow, actually, he knew how to write, this guy. I'm not sure I'm any good at that anymore.
And did any of these books create a lot of controversy, you would say?
I get mixed reactions to all my books, inevitably. I express quite strong opinions in them. The Origins of Virtue was a book that was about human cooperation, about how we are a species that is instinctively out to be nice most of the time because that pays rewards, rather than just being instinctively out to be nasty and having to be taught to be nice. That's one of the main themes of the book. And so a lot of people on the left liked it until they got to the last chapter, where I suddenly said, so actually this argues for a somewhat libertarian view of the world, that we don't have to force people to be nice in society. We can find ways of channeling their innate niceness into achieving things. The book was shortlisted for a prize, and one of the judges came up to me at a dinner slightly drunk and said, you know, we all really wanted to give your book that prize, but we couldn't because of that last chapter. We suddenly realized that you might not be a socialist, and we don't like that.
You weren't one of them.
Exactly.
I remember, because I was a student in the UK at that point when Red Queen came out, and perhaps it's because of the circles where I moved, which was in Oxford, but for some, it was almost like a rebel act to carry that book and a few other books that have been released around the time, which was taking sort of more of a scientist view on society and the evolution of man.
Yes. I mean, I think the whole notion that you could apply evolutionary principles to human beings sticks in the craw for a lot of people. It's not something they want to believe, and that will continue to be a problem. So when people say, yeah, but men and women are not different psychologically, and I would say, well, their bodies are different, and in every other mammal that we know, or pretty well everyone that we know, there are distinct behavioral differences between males and females. Why would we have sort of somehow managed to escape this pattern and not have different ways of behaving in males and females? Not necessarily the cliched ones, just, you know, but, you know, males on the whole being more competitive for mates because female gestation is a more valuable, time-consuming thing to fight over than male attention, those sort of things. Well, the interesting thing I find about The Red Queen is that I got told by a lot of men that it was a sexist book. I got told by an awful lot of women that they liked it very much. So women were saying, you know what, I've understood the battle between the sexes better. That's not, by the way, the main theme, the whole of what the book's about, the battle between the sexes, but it was one of the things I discussed. And an awful lot of women have told me that they found that book very helpful in understanding men and understanding women too.
Huh. That surprised me a bit, but I think, you know, I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but now that you're saying it, I can see that point. Anyway, Matt, let's move on to your new book, Innovation, and the mechanics of innovation that you write about in the book. So the pandemic now has, I think, shown us the importance of innovation. But still, I think a lot of people will put a question mark on the understanding on how they actually come about. I suppose the most common perception of innovation is that they are the results of geniuses at work, and that the more we get to use the brain power of brilliant minds, the more innovation we're going to get. So what would you say is wrong with that perception?
I think that is a mistake. Of course, being clever is better than being stupid, as it were, and some extraordinarily talented people have contributed to innovation over the years and over the centuries. But the more you examine innovations, the more you find that it is a team sport, a collective contribution. It results from a series of pre-innovations that enable the person to put the final piece of the puzzle in place, and post-innovations that enable the innovation to go on improving. And I think if you just ask yourself about some of the things that have changed human life most in our lifetimes, the computer, the internet, the mobile phone, and you ask yourself, who is the genius who invented each of them? You quite quickly realize it's a rather stupid question. Of course, we don't expect to find one person who invented the internet. I mean, you can say that Tim Berners-Lee deserves credit for the World Wide Web, but even then, he was building on the work of others, and others built on his work. You can say that Vint Cerf and people like this contributed key technologies to making the internet possible. It's the same with the computer. I go on a hunt for the first computer in my book to try and work out, you know, which was the first device that can be called the computer. And it's an impossible question to answer. I mean, most people think it was a thing called the ENIAC in Philadelphia, but it lacks all sorts of features that it needed, that other computers had. And anyway, the idea of a computer precedes it, and several different people had different ideas that contributed to it and so on. So it makes much more sense to think of these things as gradual, to think of them as collaborative enterprises rather than individual ones, particularly because a new technology is nearly always a combination of existing technologies. That is to say, we recombine technologies in different ways to make new. We recombine the atoms of the world in new configurations. And so the great breakthroughs come from people bringing ideas from one field into another field and combining them in different ways.
So going back sort of to that perception that I started with, I think there's sort of one element of it which is, in practical terms, sort of still pretty strong in the general public opinion, which is that if you look at the evolution of important innovation, there is going to be almost a beeline between, on the one hand, a scientific discovery, and on the other hand, the result of that discovery, which is going to be a product or service or technology which gets employed in different ways by companies and then delivered to customers. Would you say, is that the traditional sort of, if we look back at history, that's the way that most innovation get done, that first something happens in a scientific lab somewhere at a university in the UK or America or elsewhere, and then businessmen will get hold of that knowledge and put it into practice?
Well, it's not really the common pattern, because if you think back to older innovations like the steam engine, it doesn't come about because people study thermodynamics. In fact, the reverse happens. It's through studying how steam engines work that scientists come up with the idea of thermodynamics. And that is surprisingly common, that it's the technology that leads to the scientific understanding rather than vice versa. Now, obviously, in recent years, with much greater academic scientific research happening, it's inevitable that some of those will lead to applications. But this linear model, where you start with the science and you end with the application, has actually been a sort of problematic myth in this area for many decades. And most people who've written about it have said that this isn't actually how it usually works. It's an interplay between them. And to give you a modern example of that, I would choose CRISPR, the genome editing technology that has been developed within the last 10 years to enable us to make very precise interventions in changing sequences in genes, either for medical or for agricultural purposes. And if you look at how this came about, it looks at first sight like a purely academic discovery in universities, Berkeley, California, MIT, and a number of other places in Europe. Some very clever people in some universities have put together this technology as a result of their understanding of particular sequences inside bacterial genomes. But then when you look a bit closer, you find that where did they get this insight from? Where did they find these bacterial sequences? They got it from the yogurt industry, because the yogurt industry has a problem, which is that every now and then the bacteria on which it relies get sick. They get sick because they catch a virus. So the yogurt industry employs bacteriologists to study how bacteria resist virus infections. And one of the things they spotted was that there was some interesting, if rather obscure, research going on in a project funded by the salt industry in a Spanish university at Algeciras, into some sequences stored away inside the genes of bacteria, which seemed to be viral sequences, and which might be a library of virus sequences stored by the bacterium as a means of identifying enemies, as it were. This is exactly what this turned out to be, this CRISPR-Cas9 system. And so without the practicalities of an industry trying to solve a problem, you wouldn't have got the scientific breakthroughs, which would then lead to another application. That's a much more common pattern, I think, to understand the relationship between science and application. There's quite an interesting story that Charles Townes, the inventor of the laser, told, which rather goes to the heart of this question of whether or not it's the original idea or the development of it later that really counts. He talked about a beaver and a rabbit looking at the Hoover Dam. And the beaver is saying to the rabbit, "No, I didn't build it, but it is based on an idea of mine." And that rather gets to the heart of how we tend to overestimate the original idea rather than the application later on.
Indeed. And as you say, many of the developments that we've seen throughout history, they have been the result of different people contributing to the development itself. And apart from that point about team sports and the evolutionary view of innovation, you list also in your book what you called innovation essentials. Could you please tell us a little bit more about what these essentials are?
Yes, innovation is a relatively gradual phenomenon. If you look at Moore's law, it doesn't show great jumps when you have new technologies coming along like the integrated circuit. It just shows a steady progression, much more gradual than we think, much more incremental. It depends heavily on serendipity, that is to say, ideas coming from an unexpected direction. That is quite a common phenomenon in innovation. It's different from invention. That's the point I make about coming up with a prototype is sometimes the easy part. Developing that prototype to the point where many different people can have access to and afford the product is even more hard work than the original idea. Edison said that it is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. It's an evolutionary phenomenon, as we've discussed. That is to say, there's a huge amount of trial and error, of natural selection goes on. Most of the great innovators talk about solving the problem by doing lots of experiments until you find the solution, not having one clear idea of how to do it. It's collective, as I say, you need to draw on the minds of lots of different people. It tends to underperform in the short run and overperform in the long run. This is something that Roy Amara, a computer scientist, first spotted in the 1960s, is that we underestimate the impact of new technologies in the long run, but we overestimate them in the short run. And that can be very deceptive. One of the effects of this is that there's something sort of inevitable and inexorable about evolution once it gets started. I mean, when you think about it, once the motor car had been invented, the lawnmower and the chainsaw were probably inevitable. You know, you would once you've got a good petrol motor that can turn a wheel, you'll use it for all sorts of things. But also, there is an inevitability about the light bulb in the 1870s. 21 different people come up with the idea independently. The contributing technologies like vacuums and glass and electricity have reached the point where it's sort of inevitable. There's a huge inevitability about the search engine in the 1990s. And yet, and this is another feature of evolution, nobody sees the search engine coming. If you read what people are saying in the 1980s about the internet, very few of them say, oh, by the way, one of the most important features is going to be a device that enables you to find what you want to find in the internet. And that's probably the way most people are going to access the internet, and that's probably the way to make money out of it. Nobody is saying that. Indeed, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, as they invent Google, they don't even think they're inventing a search engine. They think they're cataloging the internet. So these are some of the features that I think it's important to understand when you're talking about innovation, and some of them go against the myths that are out there.
I suppose one of the myths are that you can, as a government, create a lot of policies that will lead to innovation. I mean, that's what most of the governments are doing. They are spending a lot of money on research budgets going to universities, and they expect that one of the results of all that money will be that lots of new innovations will come out as a consequence of it. They also do many other things. But I get from your book sort of that you're pretty skeptical of that view of how innovations come about. You're skeptical about the view, which we've heard from some economists, saying sort of that, well, at the end of the day, it's the government that has created many of the breakthrough innovations that we've seen, and companies may have prospered from them, but they have done so not because they invented the things, but because they were sort of just taking things that the government had been funding. We have sort of the argument in the book, the entrepreneurial state, for instance, where that argument comes out pretty strongly. But you don't seem to subscribe to that view.
Yes, I think that, I mean, the first thing to say is that, of course, government can contribute to innovation. It would be odd if it couldn't. After all, it's spending some 40% of our money, and it's a good thing that some of that be spent on innovation. If it's going to take that much money, then you wouldn't want it spending nothing on innovation. But the view that we only have technologies because government originally invented them and the private sector is the beneficiary of them is, I think, completely wrong. It partly makes the mistake of the beaver and the Hoover Dam. You know, the government may have developed GPS navigation systems originally, but that doesn't mean there wasn't an awful lot of work by the private sector to turn that into products that are of use to us. But it tends to overemphasize the degree to which these things would have been invented anyway. So, for example, you will see the argument that there's a huge list of things that came out of the Apollo program. From nonstick frying pans to I can't remember what, lots of other things that we wouldn't have if we hadn't had the Apollo moonshot program. And when you think about most of these items on the list, that's clearly nonsense. In fact, it's not even true of nonstick frying pans. Teflon was invented inside DuPont by somebody looking for one kind of product, came up by good fortune with another, and it was then used in the Apollo program. But that doesn't mean it was invented for the Apollo program. So it's genuinely wrong, I think, to see government as the originator of most of these things. If you think about computing for a minute, the argument is often made that without government heavily investing in computing during the Second World War, we wouldn't have had computers. Well, actually, when you look at it, the Second World War probably slowed down the development of computers because all the key breakthroughs and ideas really happened around 1937, when nobody was at war, apart from the Spanish Civil War. That then resulted in all these projects being cut off from each other, a very promising German team, a couple of very good American teams, which had worked in isolation from each other, Alan Turing and colleagues in the UK, and so on. And these people were all diverted into either cryptography or calculating the trajectory of artillery shells for the next 4 or 5 years in isolation from each other and unable to put together their ideas, the idea of a digital computer, the idea of an electronic computer, the idea of stored programs and so on. And of course, it all then begins to flourish after the war ends, and a lot of it in the private sector. The government is in the habit of picking winners when it looks at new technologies. At least it thinks it's picking winners. But the problem with that process, as Professor Dieter Helm has said, is that losers are good at picking governments. And you often find that governments champion bad ideas and get in the way of good ideas when they're trying to encourage innovation. So the main role of government should be, yes, make sure some public money goes to research and development, but don't try and specify the outcome, because that isn't the way innovation works. Try and clear the obstacles away from entrepreneurs and innovators who can improve and tinker with technologies to get better versions of them.
I suppose most governments would say that over the past decades, they are doing more and more in order to create an environment which is more hospitable to innovators and to other people that wants to experiment and test things to see what can come out of these experiments. Would you agree with that view? Have we sort of in the West, I should say, created a better environment for the type of entrepreneurs and innovators that we'd like to see?
I think on the whole, we have not done that. Trying to make the tax system more rewarding for entrepreneurs is something that we have seen in a number of countries. The UK has done quite a lot in that respect, and we've seen many small startups and tech entrepreneurs getting going. But at the other side of the equation is the regulations that get in the way of entrepreneurial activity, which essentially say, in order to do something new, you have to get permission from an official. And because it's new, the official doesn't know whether it's safe or not. And so he is incentivized to delay a decision. You saw this very clearly in the case of genetically modified crops in the European Union. They've never been banned, but they have taken a very, very long time to be approved. And you give the example in your book, The Innovation Illusion, of the story of BASF and a genetically modified potato, which took something like 8 years of really ridiculous, Kafkaesque excuses for postponing a decision that resulted in BASF giving up and moving its whole research program to the United States. So I think the degree to which governments have been lobbied by activists on the one hand in the environmental movement and others, by incumbent industries who don't want competition. You've seen this very clearly in the case of vaping, where the pharmaceutical industry has been lobbying behind the scenes to prevent any competition for their patches and gums, and by others who are resistant to change. That is where governments could make the most difference, is by standing up against these interests that try to stop innovation. And on the whole, government has helped these interests rather than hindered them. And I feel that that's the most important thing that government should be doing, rather than just, as it were, putting money into universities in the hope that innovations come out the other end.
Indeed. I think the example you gave also points us to another thing, which is that governments can quite often not just stand against the process of innovation, but they may actually actively conspire against innovation. The example with the BASF GMO potato, I think, is a good classic example of that. But we can find thousands of other examples when governments have actively been trying to reduce the impact of a new innovation that has come out.
Yeah, and it's worth contrasting that, I think, with action by a government that does work, that did encourage innovation very effectively. And the example I would choose is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act passed by the Clinton administration in, I think, 1996 or 1998, around that time. And that act was extremely permissive. That is to say, it was specifically designed to encourage electronic commerce, to encourage online commercial activity. And it, one of the ways it did so was by saying that you are not a publisher if you run a website, you are a platform. So you cannot easily be sued for what gets said on it. And that and other measures around the same time had an enormous impact on the development of e-commerce in the United States, which spread around the world. So that's an example of where a government can do something right, but it was very much in the nature of a negative encouragement. It wasn't government setting out saying, these are the rules by which e-commerce is going to work. It was government saying, these are the things that we're going to make sure do not happen to you if you start an e-commerce business. I contrast that with the way the governments around the world have reacted to drones, consumer use of small unmanned aerial vehicles. They've tended to say, right, we're worried about this, so you mustn't ever let a drone go out of sight. You mustn't let it go above 500 feet. You mustn't have it weigh more than a certain amount. You mustn't use it near an airport. Trying to think of all the things that people might do wrong with a drone, rather than just saying, as the sort of common law would, if you cause harm with a drone, we will prosecute you. That's all you need to say. And then you can leave it up to the courts to work out whether or not you caused harm. And that throws the onus back on the drone makers to say, right, well, how are we going to make sure that our product is safe? But at the same time, it doesn't put little fences around the technology that prevents innovation in that technology in order to make it a more and more advantageous product.
Wouldn't you say, Matt, that this is also an example of how many people take, or at least have a perception about innovation, which is almost sort of a command and control type of exercise, where there is very little respect for exactly what you've talked about now and what you write about in the books, that sort of evolutionary process, the team sport approach to innovation, that no one really knows what's going to happen when we start a development project of any kind. No one really knows what the consequences of a new scientific discovery is going to be. But at the same time, we have sort of an epistemological instinct that if we can't control the outcome of that discovery or the outcome of that particular knowledge, then it's something dangerous going on, right?
Yes, and I would go even further, and I would say it's a problem of creationism. That is to say, for hundreds of years, we looked at the natural world and we saw complexity and order and a beautiful fit between form and function in the shapes of bodies and ecosystems and organs within bodies and things. And we said, there's no way this kind of complexity and sophistication could have come about without a designer. There must be a deity who designs these creatures. And then along comes Charles Darwin and says, no, there's another way that this can come about, through spontaneous order, through very, very gradual experimentation on a vast scale that leads to good ideas being kept and bad ideas rejected until you get a huge degree of complexity. Now, I think we still make the same mistake about all sorts of aspects of human society, that we look at a problem and say, oh my goodness, the government caused that, or the government needs to stop that, or the government needs to be in charge of that. We treat government like we used to treat God in explaining the natural world. And I like to give the simple example of feeding a city. If in a normal day, when you're not having a pandemic, some 10 million people would eat lunch in London on an average day. Each of them would decide at the last minute what they were going to eat. Or in most cases, some of them might make their sandwiches in the morning. But anyway, the point is, how on earth is the right amount of food of the right kind in the right place at the right time to achieve that? Who's in charge of that process? I mean, it's a very important process. We don't want people going hungry. So it deserves to have someone put in charge of it, surely, and directing it and coordinating it and planning it. London's lunch commissioner. He's obviously a very talented individual, because I have never heard of a case in which London suddenly went hungry one day, or large numbers of people couldn't get what they want for lunch in London that day. Well, of course, the London Lunch Commissioner does not exist. It is a market. It is a bottom-up process that produces the result. And I think we see the same instinct with respect to innovation. As soon as an innovation comes along, people are dashing to parliamentary chambers and saying, let's draw up some rules for how to control and direct this, rather than let's let it evolve, but at the same time, telling it that if it does any wrong, we'll come down on it like a ton of bricks.
That story about the London Lunch Commissioner reminds me of a phrase that I think it's Nassim Taleb that originated it, and he calls it the Soviet Harvard illusion.
Yes.
This instinct that we think we can accumulate all relevant knowledge in the hands of one person or a committee, and as a consequence, they can make good decisions about, in this case, what people should eat, when they should eat, and how perhaps they should find sort of the logistics behind it to get to the restaurant, etc. But that's a very strong cultural instinct, I think, this notion that society would work better if we could accumulate all knowledge in the hands of a couple of individuals that could make those decisions. And it seems to me that runs against the entire ethos of the innovation process.
I think that's right. And Hayek, of course, made this point in his famous essay, The Uses of Knowledge in Society, that the knowledge is distributed. And then Leonard Reed wrote this wonderful essay in the 1950s called I, Pencil, in which a pencil tries to find out how it came into existence, decides that millions of people were involved in its manufacture, and that not one of them knew how to make a pencil. We are constantly doing things that are beyond the capability of individual brains. Inventing nuclear reactors, you know, is not something that any individual is clever enough to do. But collectively, between us, by sharing our knowledge, we are capable of doing that. That's why it's quite important to get away from a sort of directed command and control, and also a heroic view of innovation. So in some ways, the argument that I'm making here is a sort of somewhat communitarian one. But the trouble with a lot of communitarians is that they think that leads immediately to putting the state in charge. And I think that's exactly the wrong twist at the end of the argument.
Yeah, no, I would certainly agree with that. I want us to talk a little bit about other forces that may stand against innovation. You have a very good chapter called The Resistance to Innovation. You start off with a quote by William Petty, and it goes like this. When a new invention is first propounded, in the beginning every man objects, and the poor inventor runs the gaunt loop of all petulant wits. Do you think, is that the common experience of a lot of people that have introduced new innovations to the market, that they've been sort of haunted by a lot of people who think that they are stupid, silly, or just simply crazy?
Yes, I think this is true. I think that it's far from us enthusiastically adopting new things. We actually are very quick to reject innovations and inventions and find reasons for worrying about them. So I give examples in the book of how much resistance there was to innovations in the past, like coffee. Coffee was banned again and again and again in the Middle East and in Europe by rulers for two reasons. One, because they were being lobbied by the wine or beer industry, and two, because they worried that people would go to coffee shops to drink coffee. And when they were there, they might have conversations. And these conversations might include whether or not the ruler was doing a good job. And this is very explicit in some cases. King Charles II in England, when he banned coffee houses, said the reason is because people are telling lies in them. It's fake news that's going on here. Margarine was banned in several American states because of the interests of the dairy industry. The hansom cab operators objected to the introduction of the umbrella. The Horse Association of America had a long campaign against tractors on the grounds that they were dangerous. It's amazing when you think about it that anything gets through this sort of gauntlet. There's this weird word gaunt loop in that quote by William Petty, but I've never found the word anywhere else. So I think, yeah. I don't know whether it was a misprint or just a 17th century version of the word gauntlet. But you know, the inventor has to run this gauntlet, and it's surprising that any get through. In the case of something like mobile telephony, the individual benefit to the consumer of having a phone in your pocket was so great that even the objectors couldn't win, as it were. So there were a lot of attempts to say these things are dangerous, they're frying your brain, etc., etc. And you still see some echoes of it going on today with the sort of 5G caused corona stuff. Actually, the benefit was too great. But with something like a genetically modified organism, that where people don't feel the individual benefit to themselves, then yes, society can decide to reject whole technologies completely. And I think far from living in an age where, you know, ridiculous things like banning coffee or margarine no longer happen, I'm afraid we live in an age where actually we're quite good at preventing innovations getting established. Look at what's happened to shale gas. Look at what's happened to vaping. Look at what's happened to genetically modified organisms. Look at what may be going to happen to gene editing. You know, as Peter Thiel says, except in the digital sphere, we don't have as much innovation as we would like to have at the moment.
I'm curious about that reaction from a large part of the population. I mean, it was my experience too after my co-author Björn Weigel and I had launched the book that we got a lot of people, especially in the corporate sector, that was furious about the message we were giving them. And to summarize the message in one sentence, it was that, you know, a lot of people think we live in the most innovative of times, but actually we don't. And one of the reasons for it is that a lot of people actually resist innovation. And that can be people in government, in companies, it could be customers, etc. And I thought about that quite a lot, why the reaction was so strong. And then I started to ask people, so do you want more innovation in your life? And if you would want more innovation in your life, you need to be prepared to give up something as well, because most of the good innovations we're seeing, they lead to changes in behavior. You stop doing things in order to start doing other things. So what would you like to stop doing in your life? And every time I got that, I asked that question, I didn't get any answer at all, because people just thought that their lives was just perfectly fine.
How really interesting. I think that's fascinating. One of the things your book brings out so well is the degree to which corporate behavior has become relatively conservative, anti-change, relatively stagnant. The power of big companies has increased, and big companies are always resistant to innovation. We know this, you know, like Kodak, they sit and watch when the rug is pulled out from under them. And the degree of corporate resistance to innovation was something that I hadn't really thought about until I read your book. But I think that's really interesting that people have a huge loss aversion, and they don't like the idea of losing whatever it is that they've got in order to get something better. And you see this, of course, expressed in the precautionary principle, which has gone now to ridiculous lengths to hold the new to a different standard than the old. So an existing technology with flaws, with dangers, with risks attached to it is fine. But a new technology that has fewer risks, but a new risk attached to it is not fine. Because we measure the new risk, we don't measure the new benefit, and we don't measure the reduction in the old risk. That's what the precautionary principle effectively forces us to do.
Indeed. No, and it's very much sort of a, not just an anti-innovation principle, I think it's an anti-evolution principle as well, in the sense that it prohibits us from the normal course of the way we develop things.
You see this very clearly in the nuclear industry, where we've been unable to use trial and error to improve nuclear technologies.
Absolutely.
Because we obviously don't want errors, but we then... The way we license nuclear power plants is we specify in huge detail, many years in advance, exactly which screw and bolt is going to be in which place, which cuts the industry off from the process of learning by doing that is normal in innovation.
Indeed. Anyway, Matt, I want us to talk also about innovation and the health sector, and especially in light of the situation now with coronavirus. I think, you know, we all hope, of course, that we soon can have access to antiviral drugs or vaccines, or perhaps both. And before asking you about the outlook for these, which you have written about in The Spectator very recently, I wanted us to step back and look at where we stand. In your book, you go through innovation in the world of infectious disease, and you give a fascinating account of how we develop vaccines against, you mentioned smallpox, rabies, polio, and also something I knew, which I didn't know about before, whooping cough. But now, when we are confronted with this pandemic, at least my impression is that most of the people, most of the companies, most of the scientists that have been involved in developing vaccines against the virus, they start from scratch, almost as if they had no prior knowledge or that they had no help from previous work that's been done. Perhaps that's just me being unfair, but I wanted to start this conversation with a quote, which is from the afterword of your book. And in that quote, you talk about innovation and the Human Vaccines Project, and you say, "It was precisely to solve this problem that the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations was founded in 2017, with money from the Wellcome Trust, the Gates Foundation, and the Indian and Norwegian governments. But somebody, probably the World Health Organization, should have done this far sooner. By 2020, this center, CEPI, had barely started on the road to inventing a vaccine development platform that is adaptable to any new disease and ready to go. By far the biggest failure of the 2020 pandemic is the failure to have done enough innovation in the field of vaccines. It took me by surprise, for sure." So, Matt, what went wrong?
Well, it's a really interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I'm amazed to discover that it takes normally several years, often up to a decade, to make a new vaccine in this era. The whooping cough vaccine that you mentioned there was developed by two very diligent women in Michigan in the 1930s in 4 years flat. That would be considered quite a good achievement today. So why is this? Well, the pharmaceutical industry on the whole does not invest in vaccines because it can't make money out of them. A vaccine, if it works, does itself out of business very quickly. And the governments of the world have on the whole got bored of infectious diseases, and the World Health Organization likewise has gone on and on about climate change or obesity instead, because people aren't that interested in infectious diseases. They're a problem we've largely defeated. They're mostly a problem in developing countries. And despite the warnings, and there were some explicit warnings, I didn't spot them, but others did, of what was happening in wildlife markets and with the discoveries of viruses in bats that were pre-adapted to human infection. Despite these warnings, nobody was taking vaccine development as an urgent and important priority for the world health system. So I think this is a very good example of a neglected area of technology. And it probably isn't helped by the anti-vaccination movement, which has, while it's not won the establishment over to its side, has nonetheless sort of constantly made it just that much harder for people to talk about vaccines as a good thing, particularly in the United States. So clearly, in the wake of this pandemic, we will put a lot more resources into finding out ways to be able to switch on vaccine development really fast in response to a new disease. I mean, there are real problems in speeding the process up, because one of the things you have to do with a vaccine is test whether it's safe and then test whether it works. And to do some of that with animals, and then you have to do some of it with human beings. And when you're testing whether a vaccine works, you have to give it to people and then see whether they become infected when they encounter the disease. It's not ethical to deliberately try and infect them with the disease. At least that's the current standard. And in the case of Ebola, a vaccine was in development, but by the time it was ready to be tested on volunteers, the Ebola problem was over, and so anybody given the vaccine was not going to encounter the virus, and therefore it wasn't possible to test whether the vaccine worked. We've got lots of different ways of developing vaccines now, things like messenger RNA vaccines, where basically the body is told to produce the antigen itself rather than the antigen being injected, things like that. But we are surprisingly old-fashioned in the way we do it.
There is an expectation now that a vaccine against coronavirus is going to be available at some point soon, perhaps already in the beginning of the autumn. I read in the Times that the British government has already set aside money in order to procure big dose of jabs that can be produced by AstraZeneca. But in the essay that you had in The Spectator, you say that you have greater hopes that an antiviral drug can be developed sooner than a vaccine. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, if we were looking at an epidemic of a bacterial disease, we would be looking for antibiotics to cure the people who catch the disease rather than just a vaccine to prevent people catching the disease. I mean, ideally, we'd want both, but we would expect therapeutic agents to be pretty high on our priority list. We don't tend to have the same optimism about viruses because it has proved very, very difficult to develop drugs that work against viruses, largely because viruses don't have their own biochemical machinery that we can attack because they borrow ours. That's their modus operandi, is to go into our cells and hijack our own machinery to make more viruses. So in attacking them, we're attacking ourselves is the problem. But I think that that has begun to change quite a lot in the last decade, largely thanks to the attempts to tackle HIV, which, note, there's still no vaccine to the AIDS virus, but there are now very effective treatments that can make it, on the whole, possible to save people's lives if they catch HIV. These protease inhibitors turned out to be the way to go, slightly unexpected, because protease is an enzyme that splits a protein in two. It turns out that a lot of viruses use such a thing as part of their method of getting inside a cell. So inhibiting that kind of enzyme can be effective in stopping the virus without hurting ourselves too much. But then Ebola came along, and likewise, there was an attempt to understand how to cure Ebola patients, and drugs like remdesivir and other drugs were developed, which are effectively drugs that give a fake version of a nucleotide to the virus so that it builds a protein that doesn't work, and that stops it in its tracks. Now, neither of those are examples that can be taken off the shelf and applied directly to COVID-19, but I suspect that we have learnt enough from them that antiviral development is going to happen relatively fast. Because we've also got things like convalescent plasma, which is basically giving blood from people who've been cured, and things like monoclonal antibodies. So we've got lots of different ways of coming up with treatments for COVID that might well be effective. And when you think how most people are able to resist this virus fairly successfully anyway, it might not take much to just tip this over into being a cure that damps down the disease enough so that it dies out. So, for example, there's a Japanese drug known as Avigan, or the actual name is favipiravir, which was originally developed against influenza, which is showing some promise against COVID. And one of the ways it does so is shortening the time by which you're infective. Now, that could make a big difference because the virus hugely depends on being able to jump into the next victim. And if you're only infectious for a shorter time, then you're going to infect fewer people. And so that makes it easier to drive down the rate of infectivity. So I have not huge hopes, but some hopes that some of these drugs will be sufficiently effective that they will make a difference even before we get to a vaccine.
Finally, Matt, I want us to talk a little bit about innovation in the field of health medicines, as we talked about just now. I mean, as I said previously, you go through health in your book. You talk about the development of lots of innovations that we've seen coming through history. But one thing which I find a bit odd is that we still have many health challenges where we expect innovation to be a critical component in the way that society is going to fight these diseases. We've had a war on cancer since the early 1970s, and still there are lots of things that we haven't done in terms of being able to cure cancer. We have lots of different problems with everything from Alzheimer to dementia, where we also lack medicines or the type of pharmaceuticals that could help to at least alleviate the problem in a more effective fashion than we can do right now. One part of me thinks that we need to be sort of respectful of the knowledge challenge here, that there are lots of things that we just don't know, and that is going to take a lot of time to develop the knowledge that is necessary in order to develop the new innovations that are going to help us against cancer or Alzheimer. But another part of me also think that we have market or market regulatory problems here that are holding back the developments. And I wanted to ask you about that. So when you look at perhaps not just the health sector, but also other sectors, do you see market regulatory problems here that stands in the way for helping us to solve the big problems? We've talked about, and you talk about this in a book, the process for market approvals in the healthcare sector. We have problems with funding and reimbursement issues. But what about issues like patents, for instance? Do you think we have now organized policy in a way which makes it difficult for us to basically get closer to the point where we can cure cancer or cure any other disease that is hurting us a lot now?
These are really good points, and I don't fully know the answers. I do agree with you that something like mental illness is a good example of something where we have clearly not done enough innovating. You know, we've done far too little innovation in order to be able to tackle the growing problems of innovation. Our failure to cure Alzheimer's at all after huge amounts of research is pretty shocking when you think about it. And I think a big part of that is that we may have been barking up the wrong tree. The obsession with the plaques and tangles and the I can't quite remember the name of it, but the sort of hypothesis that has been foremost in the Alzheimer's work seems to have been focused on the symptoms, not the cause. And this has become a paradigm in the sciences, which has prevented other more maverick ideas about how to tackle this issue coming to the fore. So that's an example of too much, as it were, consensus getting in the way of experimenting and trial and error, which is what we need to be able to do in that area. You mentioned also diagnostic and other medical devices and how they are often very, very slow to get approved, and how that has deterred innovators and entrepreneurs from going into that field, and they've gone off into other fields instead. You mentioned patents. I personally think that the evidence is quite clear that on the whole, in most areas, patents are a hindrance, not a help now. They're too strong, too easy to get. They last too long. When they expire, you see a burst of innovation. They don't tend to be fair because they tend to reward one person or one firm when there are lots of other contributors in a team. And the evidence from different countries and different periods of history is that loosening or tightening patents doesn't decrease or increase the rate of innovation at all. So I do think we have to rethink that system. We've created, particularly in the health and biotech area, what are sometimes known as patent thickets or patent toll booths, whereby if you and I start a biotech company and we try to tackle Alzheimer's, go into it, we find that along the way, we're going to need to deal with such and such a system, such and such a molecule, such and such a procedure, and it's been patented by someone else, so we have to buy a license from them. It's like paying a toll when you go up the River Rhine in the Middle Ages every few miles, because there's a different ruler around each corner and he wants to extract a tariff from you. So I do think that intellectual property needs a comprehensive rethink. I think you've written about this, but so has Brink Lindsay in his book, The Captured Economy. And, you know, it's not just patents, it's copyright too. The copyright system is largely broken down in the music industry so that performers are not able to reap the rewards of songs they wrote in the past to the same degree. has that resulted in a collapse of innovation in the music industry? I would say not. We extended the life of copyright dramatically in recent years after lobbying from the Disney Corporation and others, with the result that my grandchildren can make money from my books 70 years after my death if they're bestsellers. Well, I think that's outrageous. I think they should go and get a job instead.
Indeed. No, in Brussels, we have also got used to the fact that we quite often see people like Paul McCartney, Bono, and other coming to town every time there is a decision, or at least there is a proposal to extend or reduce the period for the copyright, which is really strange. Anyway, really finally, Matt, and now I literally mean finally, because I'm going to read from you the last paragraph of your book. And it says, I ended my book in a mood of unaccustomed pessimism, lamenting the innovation famine that seems to have gradually developed, courtesy of complacent big companies, bureaucratic big governments, and neophobic big protest groups. With some exceptions, mostly in the digital world, the innovation engine is sputtering and society is not seeing as many new products and services of value as it needs. COVID-19 has driven home that message in emphatic fashion. It is time to let innovation work. So my question is, has the rational optimist become a rational pessimist?
Not entirely. I still think that we will get through this pandemic. We will continue innovation. We will hopefully have it happen in countries where it's allowed to flourish. But we aren't engaging as much innovation as we should. We're missing out on so much by not encouraging it more and not allowing it more. And there is just a smidgen of a possibility, a pretty small one, that we could shut down this engine altogether and retreat into a sort of mystical Middle Ages, as the Ming Empire did when it shut down the innovation engine of China, which had been whirring so beautifully up until that point.
All right, Matt Ridley, thank you so very much for a fascinating hour of discussion with you.
Frederick, it's been really enjoyable talking to you, and thank you again for your fantastic book, The Innovation Illusion, which, as I said, was a big influence on me.
All right, thank you for that. No, that's too kind of you, Matt.